Today's resolution, the Austrian Economics of Mises and Rothbard, contains economic intuitions that are important, correct, and missing from the Chicago School economics. Taking the affirmative is Gene. No, I'm not the one who didn't kill himself, Epstein.
That was Cousin Jeff, yeah.
Gene earned a Bachelor of Arts from Brandeis and a Master of Arts in Economics from the New School. He was the economics editor of Barron's magazine from 93 to 2018. He taught economics at the City University of New York and St. John's University. And he was the senior economist for the New York Stock Exchange. He's an associate scholar of the Mises Institute and has written and spoken about economic topics from an Austrian perspective. Most relevant, Gene is a good friend of the Free State Project. And of course, he is the founder and executive director of the Soho Forum, which emphasizes an approach to reveal even uncomfortable truths through dialogue. Tonight, he'll be championing the Austrian school economists, such as Karl Menger and his subjective theory of value. Eugen von Bumbrock, his work on interest payments as a reward for waiting. Friedrich von Weiser, how work on marginal utility, opportunity costs, and business cycle. Friedrich Hayek, his work on business cycle and his critique of central planning. And, of course, Ludwig von Mises, his work on praxeology, money, and credit, and his critiques of socialism and government interventionism. Now, Austrians like to say something about the Chicago School of Economics. Nothing says economic stability like a financial crisis every decade. So, taking the negative to defend the Chicago School is David. No, I'm not the one who represented Donald Trump's in court. Friedman. Please take the stage, Dave. David attended Harvard, where he earned a BA in chemistry and physics. He then went on to earn his master and PhD in physics in 1971 from the University of Chicago. David learned about economics. Basically, like most of us have, through reading. And arguing with his father, probably one of the most famous Chicago school economists, Milton Friedman. His seminal book, The Machinery of Freedom, Advocating an Anarcho-Capitalist Society from a Consequentialist Perspective, is a must-read for libertarians. Most importantly, David is a great friend of the Free State Project and always has been coming to Porkfest since I've been here. And he has debated twice in the Soho Forum, both times Gene. David will be defending the Chicago economists such as George Stigler, his work on economics and information, government regulation, and the market. Frank Knight, his work on risk, uncertainty, the role of the entrepreneur. Ronald Coase, his work on transaction costs. Gary Becker, his application of economic analysis to social issues, including crime, discrimination, and family behavior. And of course, Milton Friedman, his leadership in monetary history and theory. Now, some in the Chicago School have dismissed the Austrians, saying something as outrageous as they are so old school, they still calculate GDP with an abacus and a quill pen. So what we're going to have is the first 17 and a half minutes for the affirmative, Gene Epstein. Gene?
Well, thanks. I'm back again in a different guise. My friend Dennis Pratt, I think, just outlined a 10-month, 3-hour-a-day course in Chicago economics versus Austrian economics, that would be virtually impossible to do in 90 minutes. I'm going to bore down into two specific issues. First, my own version of the background is that Austrian economics is so called because it originated with economists who came from Austria. Its most prominent member was, as Dennis mentioned, the Austrian Ludwig von Mises, who fled Europe in 1940 for New York City and ran a seminar for many years attended by the American Murray Rothbard. Rothbard went on to write works in the Austrian tradition. I'll also be mentioning Mises' own Austrian teacher, Eugen Baumbauerk. The Chicago School is indeed mainly associated with Nobel Prize winner Milton Friedman, a professor at the University of Chicago for many years, along with other U of Chicago Nobel Prize winners like George Stigler and Gary Becker. Also, my debate opponent, David Friedman, recently emailed me, quote, "I still consider myself a Chicago School economist," unquote. I consider myself an Austrian economist, but I've learned a lot from all the economists I just mentioned, including David. Both schools place an emphasis on the vital role played by free markets. But the Austrian school, unlike the Chicago school, emphasizes the central role of what my resolution calls economic intuitions. The economic intuitions that are important and correct and missing from Chicago School of Economics, as the resolution reads. I'll go with that phrase, but Rothbard also pointed out that these intuitions are, quote, based squarely in empirical reality, since they are, quote, based on universal reflective or inner experience, as well as on external physical experience. To further clarify about its what, these intuitions are not based on quantitative economic data. I'll put flesh on these bones by talking about intuitive insights that are important and specifically lacking in the work of the brilliant Chicago School economist I'm now debating, David Friedman himself. Take the concept of utility, the economist's term for the satisfaction we get as consumers from acquiring a good or service. Say you get utility out of having a massage and that you have three massage parlors with different styles to choose from, Bose, Joe's, or Moe's. Turns out you prefer Bose to Joe's and prefer Joe's to Moe's. So Bose is ranked first, Joe's second, and Moe's third. That's what is known as ordinal utility, the sort of utility endorsed by the Austrians. But here's a mental game that we sometimes play. Say we were asked, on a scale of 1 to 10, how many points would you give Bose Massage Parlor? Say you answered 8 points. Now say that in answer to the same question about Joe's, you answered 6, and for Moe's, you answered 4. Then we'd have what is called cardinal utility. For example, since you gave Bose an 8 and Moe's a 4, you value Bose's place twice as much as you value Moe's. But I think most of us would say that the scale of 1 to 10 question is just a game. We humans aren't equipped with internal calculators that can really quantify the degree of preference we might feel for one consumer good or service over another. I can even imagine that on any given day, you might even be able to say, for example, that you feel a preference for Bose over Joe's that is more intense than your preference for Joe's over Moe's. But that still doesn't validate the claims of cardinal utility, since you still can't put a number on it. Apart from that, on any given day, you'll probably offer very different numbers in response to those scale of 1 to 10 questions. Which brings us to another key point made by Austrians. What if you suddenly switch your patronage to Moe's instead of Bose? Or say you stop patronizing all massage parlors and use a massage chair instead? Are you being inconsistent in the way you order your preferences? Of course not. As Rothbard points out, ordinary utility can't accept the fact that we are rarely constant in ordering our preferences. In the real world of the consumer market, a whole range of dynamic factors can influence radical changes in the choices we make, including, but not limited to, the new products and services that are offered for sale, what stage of life we're at, and how much money we have to spend on goods and services in the first place. By contrast, as a Chicago school economist, my debate opponent David has argued that the Austrians are wrong and that economists named Neumann and Morgenstern have proven that consumer utility, that consumer utility is not ordinal, but cardinal after all. Well, maybe utility really was cardinal for Neumann and Morgenstern, and maybe it's cardinal for David, but for not for most of us. One argument David makes is that we might use money to test whether you do have a more intense preference for Bose over Joe's versus Joe's over Moe's. We decide to pay you enough money to switch from Bose to Joe's, and then enough money to switch from Joe's to Moe's. If it takes different amounts of money to get you to make one switch versus another, we have evidence that your relative preferences have different intensities. But especially if you consider the dynamic factors that influence change in consumer choice, this experiment would still not validate cardinal utility. It would still prevent us from putting precise numbers on our degree of preference. Just for starters, the amount of money you have changes over time. The amount of money required then to make you switch will also have changed, making a hash of the initial estimate of cardinal utility based on money. And then you might have switched your ordinal ranking by moving Moe's Parlor to the top of your list anyway. Also, cardinal utility advocates Neumann and Morgenstern seem to rely on examples from gambling in arguing for cardinal utility. Since I, along with many others, don't ever engage in gambling, I don't see how the argument can apply to me and many others for that reason alone. So ordinal versus cardinal utility is one important economic intuition we Austrians can teach Chicago school economists like David. The lesson of ordinal utility is important because it directly relates to the fundamental goal of a market economy, to provide satisfaction to consumers. It's also important because the belief in cardinal utility opens a potentially dangerous door. If we really subscribe to cardinal utility, the belief could be used as an excuse for status to take greater control of production and of human activity generally, based on the assumption that they can quantify our degree of satisfaction and thus maximize the total degree of utility for us all. I'll devote my remaining time to the Austrians' economic intuitions on the role of capitalists, key parts of which I think David omits to mention. One key reason is important. That it is important is that the Marxist case for wage exploitation by capitalists has been enjoying a resurgence. Take the enormous popularity of Marxist economist Richard Wolff. Professor Wolff has done a number of popular videos on the exploitative nature of capitalism. He points out that the workers' wages generally fall short of revenue taken in by the capitalists and concludes with statements like this, quote, "What is it that capitalists do? The capitalists pay the workers less than the value added by the workers when they work. The condition of your employment is that you produce more by your labor than you get paid. Welcome to the capitalist system," unquote. Well, one response came from Mises Austrian teacher Eugen von Bauwerk, whose 1896 critique of Marxist economics was called call marks and the close of his system. Bumbarak asked us to imagine five workers cooperating in the production of an engine that takes 5 years to complete, starting with the making of the tools to mine the iron ore that goes into the engine. The worker who completes the work at the end of the first year must wait 4 years to receive his share of the revenue from the sale of the engine. The worker who completes his work at the end of the fifth year will be paid almost immediately. What Bumbarak then suggests is that because of the different waiting times, the worker who must wait the longest will probably want to be paid more than the worker who's paid almost immediately. The other three workers will also want to be paid more depending on their waiting times between these two extremes. Now, Bumbarak is not necessarily assuming that the worker who is last in line will starve before he gets paid. Maybe he has enough savings to carry him through. Bumbarak is talking about what Austrians call time preference, the strong tendency for most of us, most of the time, to prefer present goods and services over future goods and services, and to want to be compensated for our waiting time if we have to wait. By pointing out that a workers' co-op would allocate payouts based on waiting time and time preference, Bumbarak is pointing out that their actions would be essentially the same as that of capitalists. The capitalists step in and pay each of the five workers immediately on completion of their work, thus solving the waiting time problem altogether for the workers. The capitalists become those who wait, pocketing the extra amounts the workers would have wanted from each other. Waiting time of the capitalists is the key reason why the workers, in Wolf's example, get paid less than the revenue received by the capitalists. Murray Rothbard adds a key perspective to this issue and, in one sense, tells the Marxists that they were more right than they knew. He writes, "It is not true that capital is an independent productive factor or that it earns interest for its owners in the same way that land and labor earn income for their owners. As Rothbard explains, if you trace things back, capital goods consisting of such items as factory buildings and desks are entirely the products of labor and natural resources. That's because to the extent that capital equipment and tools had to be used to make these capital goods, the equipment and tools had to originate solely from labor and resources. So the production of capital goods is completely imputable to labor and resources. But because production takes time, the capitalist does contribute waiting time and gets compensation for it." The entrepreneurial capitalists are also another reason why the capitalists make money. Entrepreneurship involves foreseeing unusual financial opportunity between costs and revenue. The entrepreneurial capitalists may buy capital goods on the secondary market and with labor and resources, since the entrepreneurial capitalists might foresee that the capital goods are underpriced. Or they might foresee an unusual opportunity for profit by producing a new good or service. But while entrepreneurial profits are always being made, they're often temporary for any particular entrepreneur who also faces the ever-present risk of a loss. Separately, of course, capitalists make money not by acting as capitalists, but as laborers in their own business, working as managers or innovators or both. Now compare these rich insights from the Austrians with the treatment given in the book called Price Theory, an intermediate text written by my debate opponent, David. With all due respect and to his credit, David gets a few things quite right. For example, in discussing whether there's a just distribution of income in a capitalist economy, he does write that the capitalist is due to a certain return because of waiting. But he also writes, "The wages of a laborer are equal to the market value of the additional output resulting from his labor. The interest received by the capitalist is equal to the value of the additional capital he has saved." The value of the additional capital he has saved. Both parts of that statement are vulnerable to criticism by Marxists like Professor Wolff. Contrary to David's statement, Wolf points out that the laborer's wage is not equal to the market value of the additional output resulting. It's less than the market value, and therefore the laborer is being exploited. Austrians like Baumbauer have pointed out that Wolf is right about the discount, but wrong about the exploitation. Central to this point is the role of time preference, the presence of the preference of present goods over future goods. Elsewhere in his book, David does mention that the capitalist waits for his returns, and not in this context. And nowhere in his text does David specifically mention time preference. In other work, refuting Murray Rothbard, David seems to dissent from the concept of time preference altogether, making much of the fact that we don't always place greater value on present goods versus future goods. But most of us do it most of the time, and by not mentioning and endorsing the concept of time preference, David greatly weakens his argument. Also, since the Marxists would be right that all capital goods originate from labor and resources, they could challenge David's statement that, quote, the interest received by the capitalist is equal to the value of the additional capital he has received. Contrary to David's statement, the interest received is compensation for waiting time based on time preference. I repeat, I've learned a lot from Chicago School economists, and David is a brilliant member of that school. But these are not the only examples of economic intuitions from the Austrian economists that are important, correct, and missing from Chicago School economics. Thanks.
Given the form of this resolution, I can refute Gene's position either by showing that a particular intuition is false or by showing that it is shared by Chicago. In the case of ordinal versus cardinal utility, I have the pleasure of doing both. That is to say, cardinal utility is indeed a useful idea, but if you look at the structure of Chicago economics as it is normally taught, it uses indifference curves, which were introduced by Hicks as part of the argument for switching to non-cardinal, to ordinal utility. So in fact, as a general rule, Chicago economics, like Austrian economics, uses ordinal utility. The exception is dealing with choices under uncertainty. And I am disturbed to see that Gene has such a low opinion of his fellow Austrian. Oskar Morgenstern, who along with von Neumann invented the idea of what's referred to as von Neumann-Morgenstern utility, was not only an Austrian, he was a student of Mises. So insofar as there is an argument for cardinal utility, and I think there is, it was originally an Austrian argument. I could even claim that von Neumann was an Austrian since he was born in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but he was not actually an economist, so that would be unfair. Let me explain a little bit, however, about von Neumann-Morgenstern utility, because it's a very clever and interesting idea. The way you judge relative utility is not by how much money people spend. That's an error of Gene's. It is by decisions under uncertainty. So the statement that the utility to me of A is twice that of B means that I am indifferent between a certainty of B and a 50% chance of A. And that's a very useful tool when you're trying to do economics about uncertain things. I was struck by the fact that Rothbard, who rejects the idea, nonetheless makes statements about discounting things for uncertainty. He just doesn't explain how you could do it, given that he has chosen not to use the tool that his fellow Austrian economist thought up for the purpose. The rest of his of the arguments that Gene made, I think, fail to meet the claim that they are not in Chicago economics. He went on to talk about interpersonal comparisons of utility. Cardinal utility is an entirely separate issue from interpersonal utility. If you believe in ordinal utility, you can also believe that it's interpersonally comparable, that there is a utility function for the whole population as well as for the individual. If you believe in cardinal utility, you can also believe it's not comparable, since the decisions under uncertainty are made by a single actor. So as far as I can tell, his supposed put down of cardinal utility, although it's not really a put down of Chicago economics, and Chicago economics is mostly done in ordinal utility anyway, is also a mistaken understanding of cardinal utility. Going on, he gave a perfectly reasonable explanation of the nature of capital. It is the same explanation that you would get in Alfred Marshall, who is the originator of the branch of economics that separated from Austrian. I originally wanted to put this debate in terms of Marshallian economics versus Austrian economics. Marshall is the person who, at the end of the 19th century, more or less put together what has become the dominant version of neoclassical economics. Jean objected that most people in the audience, he thought for some reason that some people in the audience would not be economists, and would therefore not recognize Marshall, but would recognize Chicago. So I agreed to do it in his terms. I would like to point out, however, that in his objecting to my describing the basis for the capitalist profit as its productivity, he is ignoring one of the implications of both Austrian and Chicago economics, which is that the value of something is equal to its marginal productivity. That is to say that capital, it is true both of capital, both that the return you get on your capital is, putting aside mistakes, the extra productivity due to the capital, and that it is the payment for waiting. Just as if you think about anything else, if you think about labor, the wage you get, the wage for the marginal worker, is both the cost of getting him to do work at the job and the value to the employer of getting him to work at the job. This is the general principle, which is usually expressed in conventional economics as marginal value equals marginal product. And I'm sorry that Gene seems to have missed that somehow in his attempt to find arguments against me. Similarly, so I'm a little surprised that he apparently supports Professor Wolff over marginal value theory, which most of us thought was a part of Austrian economics, having, I think, been invented by an Austrian a little earlier than it was invented by a Englishman. Let me go on to his idea that I somehow don't believe in time preference. You can find time preference in Marshall. You can find it in any source. What I don't believe in, and this is part of my critique of Rothbard, is that time preference has to be positive. That is to say, Rothbard and, unfortunately, Mises claim that you can deduce a priori that you will always prefer a present good to a future good. In fact, that is an observation about most people's behavior, but there is nothing in economic theory that makes it necessary. Rothbard, in fact, Mises has the bizarre idea that if people had negative time preference, if they preferred future consumption to present consumption, then they would shift all of their consumption to the future and starve to death. I'm sorry, but he really does make that argument. If you think about it, assuming you believe in declining marginal utility of income, which I think Mises does, if I had positive time preference, if I had negative time preference, if I preferred future to present, if I start out with, say, $50,000 to spend this year and next year, I will start shifting consumption towards next year, because with equal amounts of money, the marginal utility to me of income is the same in both years. But I won't shift all of it. I will just shift enough of it so that the increased marginal utility of consumption in the first year balances the decreased marginal utility in the second year due to the fact that the second year I have more income to spend. So the argument which Gene is referring to, which I indeed make in my critique of Rothbard, which he has obviously read, which I hope someday he will write a rebuttal of, the point I make there is that various things that Rothbard claims are known with certainty, in fact, are not known with certainty. They, both declining marginal utility and the usual time preference, are what we usually expect, but they don't have to be true, and one can imagine circumstances where they aren't. That my standard example for marginal utility is that the marginal utility of the fourth tire for your car is higher than the marginal utility of the third tire for the car, since you can't drive with only three tires. And that would be one of many examples of special cases where marginal utility doesn't decline. But in both Chicago and Austrian economics, we normally expect declining marginal utility. We normally expect people to prefer consumption in the present to consumption in the future, because that's the usual behavior. But that's the preference of consumption in the present to consumption in the future is if the amount of consumption is equal in both. That is, if the marginal utility of your consumption is the same in the present and in the future, if you shift your consumption so that you're consuming more in one year than another, that lowers its marginal utility and that balances the effect of time preference. Trying to see if there's anything else useful. I'm not sure there's anything, since he in fact offered only one place where, well, two places. No, I'm not sure how many places were with disagreements. But as far as I can tell, I've now made the relevant points. So I guess I might as well use the rest of my time to tell you what I think is the difference between Chicago economics and Austrian economics, at least as it is practiced, at least as Mises sees it. And that is that the Austrian approach is that you determine a priori facts of economics from basically introspection, which tells you certain things with certainty, and you then deduce facts from it. The Chicago approach is that you start out with essentially the same intuitions. You use them to form plausible conjectures. But because the world is a very complicated place, you recognize that your conjecture might be wrong, that this might be an odd case where marginal utility didn't decline. This might be an odd case where there are people who have the preference of future consumption over present consumption. You might have made a logical mistake, which some of us sometimes do. Even Mises does, as I think I just pointed out. Therefore, after you work out your plausible conjecture on the basis of the a priori theory, you then see whether it makes predictions. And when you do that, if the predictions turn out to be wrong, you try to figure out why, and one possible reason is your theory is wrong. So I think since I actually have a few more minutes, I will tell you the story of my first journal article. It was an article I wrote which was a theory of the size and shape of nations. It was an attempt to explain the map of Europe from the fall of the Roman Empire to the present. I submitted it to the Journal of Political Economy, and it was rejected. And it was rejected on the grounds that, in the view of the editor of the journal, who was George Stegler, any article to be published in his journal had to have some empirical tests. And it was a little odd, I suppose, his rejecting it since I'd known George since I was a small child. He was one of my father's best friends. But that was his rule, perfectly reasonable rule. So I redid the article, managed to figure out some ways of actually testing my theory, of predictions that followed from the theory, resubmitted it, and the article was published in the Journal of Political Economy. That was useful because I had no degrees at all in economics, and getting a job as an economist is easier if you've published an article in the top journal. But I have been grateful to George ever since, because the important lesson that I learned was not that my theory was right. I found some evidence for my theory, but very far short of proof. because the theory necessarily involved a lot of simplification of the situation. I was considering a very simple model of governments competing for territory and why some governments would be willing to spend more to grab territory than others and eventually would end up getting more territory. I had assumed away a bunch of other things. So evidence is useful, but it's not proof. The important lesson was that in order to find ways of testing my theory, I had to think it through much more clearly so that I had a better understood theory once I had asked, what are the real world implications of that theory? And that was a consequence of following the Chicago approach of submitting your theory to empirical evidence rather than the approach that many Austrians advocate, which is deducing your theory and then believing it true or false. Now, let me point you at my debunking of Murray Rothbard, because I discovered from listening to a webbed interview that Gene had with Reason a while ago that he believes that while Rothbard's political activity was not very clever, his economics were all correct. At least that's what I deduced from what he said in that interview. And I don't think it's true. So if you want to see what is wrong with Rothbard's economics, a whole lot, look on my Substack. And there is an, if you go to my Substack, if you go to my webpage, which is daviddfriedman.com, you will find there a link to a sorted list of my Substack posts sorted by topic. And if you look at the economics group, you can go down there and find a post that is a critique of a version of Austrian economics. And the version in question is Rothbard. That's based on man economy of scale and state, because I was having a debate with a Austrian friend who pointed me at man economy of state as the position he was defending. So decide for yourself. But my challenge to Gene is that he write a rebuttal to that article, assuming it doesn't convince him. Thank you.
Let me introduce the next section.
I have a rebuttal, 7 minutes rebuttal.
Well, I was going to do the...
Try to remember the schedule. I have 7 minutes rebuttal. And then
Dave,
I have 7.5 minutes.
And then we have a question. Excuse me. Then the Q&A starts a day later. So start my 7 minutes. Okay. I guess we have a bit of a protocol problem, and I blame Dennis for this completely. Dennis led you to believe that in the space of 17 and a half minutes with a little bit of rebuttal, I was going to cover all the major issues and go on and on about every different aspect of who was Austrian and who wasn't, and marginal revenue and marginal products. And since I didn't mention that, according to David, I must be unaware of it. Well, I figured what I would do is begin by quoting David Friedman's email to me. I still consider myself a Chicago School economist. And therefore, I thought that David would be most familiar with those aspects of certain key aspects of economics that David Friedman, the Chicago School economist, has spoken about. So whether those guys were Austrian or not, I'm only honing in on what my brilliant, honestly esteemed colleague David has written about economics. That is the narrow focus. And therefore, it's relevant, directly relevant and to the point, and anything else is beside the point, that David has specifically said that cardinal utility, the idea that we can quantify the fact that you like Moe's massage parlor twice as much as Joe's, that that's valid. Okay. So, but then what did David say in response, setting aside the irrelevancies about whether he was quoting Austrians or not? He's the Chicago School economist I wanted to discuss in the interest of time. What did he say? Well, he said that first, under conditions of uncertainty, the idea of cardinal utility, this idea that we all have these little quantifying engines in our minds that we can say whether we prefer Joe's twice as much as Moe's under uncertainty. Well, I cannot buy that argument that David made. Why? I don't think you should either, because obviously when we are uncertain, that's when quantification and maybe even knowing whether we have an ordinal preference is unknown. On the other hand, at any given moment, just as Rothbard emphasized, we're operating under conditions of uncertainty and we are inconstant. We are not constant in our views and our attitudes. If you go to Moe's instead of Joe's, then you're expressing an ordinal preference for Joe's over Moe's. Then, I know David mentioned and seemed to endorse the idea of indifference curves, something to which I have personally, intellectually been totally indifferent. I've never understood why David or others have got to start with the idea that there are a whole lot of goods to which we are indifferent. One of the funniest, I don't know how David is responsible for this, but Gregory Mankiw, not David's responsibility, but it was funny. He had pizza and Pepsi on indifference curves, and I thought, well, don't pizza and Pepsi go together? He forgot that you shouldn't really be indifferent. Of course, we are indifferent. It's true that we are indifferent between goods at times, but that's a very little relevance in terms of talking about what we do in real time, how we learn as consumers, how we express our preferences, and how we express our preferences ordinarily. Therefore, again, to focus on the point was, this is what David has said. David has said that cardinal utility is valid. He's the Chicago School economist whom I have vast respect, whom I've learned a great deal, and who should be in the position to defend his viewpoint. With respect to the other issues, I made a different point. I didn't start talking about all of the things that David has written about Rothbard. We could get into that if we had several more hours. But my only point was that Rothbard and others make arguments about capital and capital equipment that don't specifically get into the marginal cost issue. But David makes a hash of it. David writes in his book, "The capitalist deserves the interest he receives because it represents the cost to him of postponing his consumption." Now, that's great. He wrote that. But then the next paragraph, David is writing, "If you're completely satisfied by this argument, you have probably not understood it." Because he then goes on to talk about the interest received by the capitalist equals the value of the additional production made possible by the addition of his capital, but the marginal revenue product of capital depends in part on how much labor, land, and other input are being used, and so on. He gets into all of those other issues, but loses sight of the simple points. Yes, marginal analysis is important in that economics text 101 that David wrote, but that comes later. The first thing to understand is that capital derives from land and labor. It adds nothing but time. The capitalist adds nothing but entrepreneurship, and the capitalist adds nothing but potentially working in his company. The worker gets the discounted value because there's usually almost always a gap in time between the time that is spent for the worker to produce the good and the time that's spent to sell the good. So that's the essence of capitalism. And then when David goes off in tangents having to do with marginality and says that the marginal revenue product depends, and was it in part, on how much labor, land, and other inputs are being used, all of that is an interesting sort of digression, but it renders, it imposes confusion on the core issues about the role of the capitalist as the person who waits, the person who exercises entrepreneurship, and the person who usually works in the business as well and earns money in that way. So in that sense, one of my favorite Chicago School economists, David Friedman, could use some lessons from those specific insights of the Austrian economists. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
I'm not sure if Gene has noticed this, but Austrian economists don't always agree with each other. Neither do Chicago economists. The standard way of presenting price theory in Chicago textbooks, including mine, is in terms of ordinal utility. The relevance of indifference curves, we could have a separate argument about whether indifference curves are useful. They are a way of, they are designed by Hicks as a way of analyzing ordinal utility. The relevant history is that Pareto first proposed that you might be able to do economics entirely with ordinal instead of cardinal utility. Hicks then showed that you could do it using indifference curves. That was a way of representing preferences. And what, about 15 or 20 years later, von Neumann and Morgenstern showed that there was a way in which cardinal utility could be useful that ordinal utility could not be. That's the relevant history. So I don't think that the fact that I've argued that ordinal utility is useful that cardinal utility is useful means that Chicago economics does not include ordinal utility. In fact, it does. That's the way it's normally taught. The cardinal utility, von Neumann Morgenstern utility, is specifically useful for analyzing not a world of uncertainty, but decisions under uncertainty. If you're trying to model how people choose when they are choosing an uncertain, a lottery, as it were, a actions which might have several effects, von Neumann Morgenstern gives you a simple way of describing that. The question, Gene quoted a bit in from my textbook, where I said that if you believed that the waiting explanation is a sufficient explanation of why the capitalist deserves his income, that you didn't fully understand it. The point is that the moral proposition, you deserve almost none of the moral propositions, but in particular, the moral proposition that says, if it costs you something, therefore you deserve it, is not something that everybody agrees on. And what I was doing there was showing that on two different bases, the capitalist was entitled to his money, one of them being that he had borne a cost in order to get it, and the other being that what he had done had in fact produced something, that you had produced more by using capital than you could without capital, and that that extra production represented something he had produced and therefore that he was entitled to. That's a very oversimplified description of the argument. I can't summarize the several hundred page textbook in one argument. I can tell you that if you want an easier way of reading it, I rewrote the book a good many years later as something called Hidden Order, which was intended as a book for people to teach themselves economics, whereas the original book was intended to be used in classes. The history of that, I should say, is that I gave a copy of my price theory textbook to my favorite aunt. She gave it, probably without ever reading it, to her son. Her son gave it to his daughter. His daughter gave it to her fiancé. And I was told that the fiancé entertained the family at breakfast by reading it from my textbook. And that was the event that convinced me that I ought to rewrite it as a version intended for the general reader who wanted to have fun learning economics rather than as a textbook. That version is called Hidden Order. Unfortunately, it is not free on my webpage, as most of my books are, but you can get it at a pretty reasonable price from Amazon. Let's see, anything else that I have to say? I guess one of the things that irritates me about many Austrians is that they invent positions for the opposition and then attack them. So that the belief that Chicago School of Economics is pure empiricism, it's just look at the data and it'll tell you things, is not the way anybody does it. As I say, my first published article, I first wrote the theory. And then when George told me he wouldn't publish it without evidence, I then tested it. And that testing improved the theory. Still don't know if it's true. Most of the world is complicated enough. We don't know what production functions are. We don't know a priori what inputs it takes to produce an output. We don't know a priori what consumption functions are. We don't know what people's preferences are. It is very hard to think of any economic prediction at all which couldn't be falsified by sufficiently bizarre preferences. My standard example of that in my textbook is, why am I standing on my head on the table with a burning $1,000 bill in my toes? Because I want to stand on my head on the table with a burning $1,000 bill, between my toes. It'd be a very odd preference to have, but it's not logically impossible. So that means that you can't reach conclusions with pure theory, and that, from my view, is the mistake that many Austrians make. Let's see. I've got two more minutes. Not sure what I have to say in that. That, as far as I can tell, Gene thinks that if I argue that time preference is not invariably positive, that must mean that I don't believe in positive time preference. In fact, it is the normal pattern. It's what we normally assume, but it's not something we know with certainty. Similarly for declining marginal utility, and similar for other things. Thank you. But I do challenge Gene to write a rebuttal to my Substack post on why Rothbard's economics is mostly nonsense. Largely nonsense.
So three economists went out hunting and came across a large deer. The first economist fired, shot, 3 meters to the left. Second economist fired a second shot, 4 meters to the right. The third economist said, "We got it." So how much have they hit the mark for you guys, and how much have they not? Please line up right here for the microphone to ask your questions. And I'll go ahead and take the moderator's prerogative and ask the first question. And I'll ask of Gene. Gene, the response by the Chicago School to the Austrians is that because oftentimes Austrians do not base their findings in empirical results, they do not appear scientific. David just showed how, by basing it in empirical results, he was able to better tune his results. Can you talk a little bit to that?
Let me read a key paragraph from Ludwig von Mises, David and I would both agree is the first name you'd mention when it comes to Austrian economics. It's pretty brief. He writes, "There is economics and there is economic history. The two must not never be confused. All theorems of economics are necessarily valid in every instance in which all assumptions are given. Of course, they have no practical significance in situations where these conditions are not present. The theorems referring to indirect exchange are not applicable to conditions where there is no direct exchange. But this does not impair their validity." Now, all that point really makes is that I chose to focus on specific issues where David, a gracious Chicago School economist, has missed the boat on Austrian insights, but on the issue of establishing the economic principles and then testing them against history, because history is always just what happened this morning, David and I are in complete agreement.
And David, I will ask you your question. A response to the Chicago School's use of aggregate data is that it oftentimes leads to government policy recommendations in monetary policy and government intervention that are interventionists and that fail to account for unintentional consequences of governmental actions and that ignore the role of entrepreneurial disruptors. Can you speak to that for a moment?
I think if you actually look at the history of the last 50 years or so, you will observe that it is work such as Stigler's work on regulation that demonstrated the reasons to be suspicious of government regulation. It was my father's work on monetary history, which demonstrated that the Great Depression was in large part the fault of the Federal Reserve. The fact that the government had decided to try to manipulate the system had very bad results, not very good results. And this was in response to people, to an orthodoxy that then claimed the opposite. As far as I know, although whether Rothbard's views on the Great Depression are correct or incorrect, macroeconomics is not my field, they have had essentially no effect on the public discussion. My father's view had the result that a chairman of the Fed said, yes, I apologize, it was our fault.
Our first question, please.
Spelling, I guess.
Check. So to Gene, are market interest rates, negative market rates possible, or are they impossible or implausible, uninfluenced by a central bank? And to both, does Austrian economics have anything to add over Chicago School, specifically in the realm of business cycle theory?
With respect to if you and I agree on the definition of negative market interest rates being the interest rate below the rate of inflation, then a rate of price inflation, I should emphasize, then of course they happen all the time. The Federal Reserve does have the power, and of course central banks and other economies do have the power to do that. I would imagine David would agree with me that in a market economy that functions reasonably, it's extremely unlikely that anybody, that anybody would enter into a loan agreement or likely to be enter into that agreement at 2% if you expect the inflation rate to be at 4%. But indeed, they're possible. They do happen. With respect to the Austrian, you asked about Austrian business cycle theory, and what was the question again?
Does Austrian econ have anything to add over Chicago School econ, specifically in that realm?
Well, no, I first of all, I want to reiterate one point, take the opportunity to point out that David did get Mises wrong from the quote I mentioned, that Mises respects economic history, and economic history is, of course, all we have in front of us. And I do think that Rothbard and Mises made a contribution to our understanding about business cycle theory. And I think it was wonderful that Milton Friedman got as much attention as he did from people in power. But that in itself, of course, doesn't prove that everything he said was right. He didn't. I'll run this by David, because David, of course, doesn't claim to be a macroeconomist, but I believe David will agree with me that it didn't appear that Milton Friedman's argument was that the downturn in 29-30 could have been mild, but for the way the Federal Reserve dealt with it. However, he didn't really have a well-articulated theory about why that downturn happened in the first place, or would you correct me on that? Yeah, you see what the distinction I'm making? He criticized the way the Federal Reserve dealt with it, but he didn't have a theory as to why it happened in the first place, the downturn. He said it would have been mild rather than severe had the Federal Reserve acted better. But why did the downturn happen in the first place?
The central point, which is what Krugman gets wrong in his critique, is that the existence of the Federal Reserve, which was set up as a lender of last resort, meant that banks had much less incentive to take expensive precautions against runs on banks. And since the banks, acting in the belief that if there was a run on the bank, the Fed would bail them out, took risks they would otherwise not have taken, when the run on the bank then happened, the Fed didn't bail them out, and you got a collapse in the market.
I see. Okay.
Let me say a couple of things on the previous question. First, I agree that you are unlikely to have negative real interest rates. On the other hand, it is logically possible to have negative nominal interest rates. As Marshall pointed out, if you're in a society where there is no cheap way of storing wealth, if basically everything you're dealing with is perishable, then you might be willing, you have an income this year, you don't expect an income next year, and you want to eat next year, you might be willing to pay somebody else to transfer wealth from now till then. So it is logically possible. It's just a very, very weird kind of situation. I should say, certainly Austrian business cycle theory adds something to, really offers something different than Chicago does. I'm not a macroeconomist. My guess is that what it adds is wrong, but I could easily be mistaken. Not a field that I'm willing to argue about.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Hi. So a question for both. With diminishing marginal utility, there was an argument that David made that I didn't hear a response from Gene about, which is the four tires example. You value the fourth tire more than the third because you can't drive your car on three tires. Does that, to Gene, does that refute the idea that Austrians promote that as a matter of logical necessity, marginal utility falls as you get more units? And to David, I actually have a response to that to some degree that I've heard and not sure about. If you define the good as that which is fit for purpose, like what you can actually use, then one could simply say, and I believe Rothbard does say that the fourth tire should be considered a different good.
Rothbard actually says the fourth egg, to be precise, where you need four eggs to make a cake. But he also says elsewhere in Man, Economy, and State that money must have declining marginal utility. But if it happens that what your money is being used for is first buying the third egg and then the fourth egg, then it has rising marginal utility. So basically saying we will redefine the object every time that using the present definition of the object gives you rising marginal utility is just a way of evading the fact that marginal utility occasionally rises. And after all, the fact that the fourth egg is more valuable is due to having the first three eggs. But of course, the fact that the fourth glass of water is less valuable, the ordinary declining, is also due to the effect of having the previous glasses of what? Water. In both cases, the possession of previous units affects the value of the last unit. Usually it makes it less. Occasionally it makes it more.
I guess most I can say on behalf of David's argument is that if you have a mind as creative as his and you talk about guys who hang upside down and all the weird things that happen in the world and happen at Pork Fest all the time, for example, you can have a problem. But I don't see that there is much of a problem with Rothbard's basic statement that all value is subjective. What we purchase is subjectively determined, and it's simply an artifact of the physical world that there isn't one large egg we can buy that contains what the four eggs can do for the cake. So it seems to me that it's not really that much of a problem to say that that the good is again is subjectively defined, and the good that you need is a four egg good. That's all. There could be, we might eventually invent an egg that'll do what the four eggs will do. It might be efficient to do that. Maybe, I guess it isn't. But I think it's a hang up that really doesn't hold up. By and large, the marginal utility declines. I don't see any great problem with that when it comes to the fourth wheel of the car. Obviously, a car needs four wheels. So maybe we'll invent a car that can run on one wheel. So then we'll change that problem. But again, it's all subjective. And I think the subjectivity of the Austrians is an important thing to stress. And that's why I would come out against David with respect to his objection about the fourth egg or the fourth wheel on the car.
But of course, Chicago School economists also believe that value is subjective. Part of the problem, the problem you are facing is not that the views that you are arguing for are mostly false. It's that they are mostly views that are common to both, to all of the branches of neoclassical economics, including the Chicago School and the Austrian School.
Okay, David, that's the reason why I wanted to talk to my favorite Chicago School economist solely. David Friedman, the guy in this room. I don't know what those other guys think. That's why I thought you and I would address each other. You address me as an Austrian. I'll speak for the Austrians. You'll speak for your own views about Chicago School. By the way, since I have an opportunity, let me just ask you one question. You mentioned indifference curves according to you, an example of ordinal utility. Would you agree that it's possible to have just an ordinal utility ranking of those massage parlors and not a cardinal utility?
Of course, but the indifference curves turn out to be a set of tools that you can use to analyze in much more detail the implications of ordinal utility than you can by just talking.
Okay, well, I guess
dig a big hole with a spade too, but it helps to have a shovel, and it helps even more to have a piece of machinery.
I'm not indifferent to shovels. I there are lots of things that I'm indifferent to, and whatever I'm indifferent to doesn't seem to be a very interesting aspect of economic inquiry. There are enough problems for us to take on without belaboring the idea that we're indifferent to this or to that. Indifference seems to be pretty irrelevant. We have different views on that. Yeah.
Thank you.
But are you willing to write the rebuttal to my piece on Rothbard, which you obviously read?
David, I'm slowed down a little bit these days. Let me think about it. I'm pushing right. You like you are.
Because this kind of debate is a lot of fun.
Okay.
It really isn't a very good way of analyzing ideas.
Well, David, I'm just talking about things you as a Chicago School economist believe. I'm quoting from you. And you said you're a Chicago School.
Yes, so, but if you quote three sentences from a book, three sentences from a long article, it does not give a very detailed explanation of the idea.
Okay, but where in your book did you say that capital is strictly imputable to resources and labor? It has no independent value of its own. That's an insight of the Austrians, and I don't find that anywhere in your book. Do you think that's nonsense? I don't think it's nonsense. Oh, the capitalist makes his money just from the land and labor, the waiting time, and the entrepreneurship and the work. That's it. Nowhere in your book do you mention that.
I don't think it is nonsense, but the fact that I do not put it in your words in the book does not mean that it isn't a part of Chicago economics. And the argument about waiting goes back to Alfred Marshall.
David, you're ignoring me. I talked about capital it's not an original factor of production the way land and labor are. I think that's a key insight of the Austrians, and I don't find it in your book. That's where you could learn something from the Austrians. Yeah.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah.
Quick question. So what initially attracted me to Austrian economics is the idea that it lets the free market decide things instead of us turning all these knobs and dials. Something that attracted me more towards the Austrian and towards Chicago is that Chicago tends to focus a lot on monetary policy errors and these ideas that the monetary policy is like messing things up. David, what are your thoughts on the Chicago's versus Austrian take on a gold standard or a Bitcoin standard, which removes any possibility for monetary intervention?
The answer is that I have argued in print long ago in favor of a system of competing private issuers of currency. And as it happens, there is a interesting article about my father's views, which points out that his view was that there was no good reason why money had to be done by government, but it was not at this point politically practical to change that. Furthermore, as it happens, my father has a rather ingenious article on the optimal quantity of money, which is not the X percent rise thing. And I pointed out to him on one occasion that a perfectly competitive system of competitive issue would, in fact, produce precisely the behavior of the stock of money that he had argued was economically optimal. And he agreed with that. At least he didn't disagree. So I assume he agreed it. He usually is perfectly willing to disagree with me.
So Chicago would hypothesize that there's a practical amount of money and that might be decided by a government or something rather than just a finite denominator denominating some finite world?
That is most of the Chicago work on monetary theory is an analysis of the existing system, which is a system of government-produced fiat money. As I've said at other times, the fundamental difference between my views and my father's is not the disagreement. but the fact that I'm interested in trying to figure out how far you can carry these ideas, and he was interested in trying to figure out what you could do within the structure of the present system.
Because it's more practical, because it's a system we're living
in. More practical and less utopian, is
it? Great answer, yeah.
The idea that he was in favor of the Federal Reserve, which various Austrians seem to assert, is nonsense. That he's, you can find quotes of him. I think there's a quote somewhere saying that as far as he can remember, he's always hated the Federal Reserve.
Got it. Good answer. Do you have any idea, thoughts on a Bitcoin?
Then the Fed.
Yes. Yeah, you have a question? Yeah.
Oh, just thoughts on the Austrian's take on like the ultimate goal would be to have a finite denominator denominating a finite world, or like a Bitcoin standard or a gold standard rather than...
Like a fractional reserve or 100% reserve. Because one of Rothbard's mistakes is he insists on 100% reserve.
I like 100% reserve. I like that.
Well, look, again, just the brief answer is that there's little daylight between me and David on these issues. They're definitely you will find more reliably that Austrian economists are more interested in alternatives to the Federal Reserve than Chicago School economists. But David is certainly quite right that you can be a Chicago School economist and want to abolish the Fed and see the benefit of that. All that is quite true, and it is a matter of emphasis. By the way, David, let me take one other opportunity to ask you this question. The one essay that Milton Friedman wrote, which I guess it's indicative that it got discussed and attacked, and I think he never responded to his critics, was this methodology paper. Okay, I think I'll explain it for the audience, but maybe you'll explain it better. But the core thing that he talks about a billiard table in his example, they're playing billiards. And an economist doesn't have to understand the rules of the game. He can just map out what's going to happen based on empiricism. And that was seemingly a bit of an embarrassment. He never actually did that in his economics, though. But I'm just curious, when did that paper come from?
I don't remember the billiard table, but his positive economics essay was arguing that your theory did not have to be precisely true. Because, in fact, you're usually dealing with things that are too complicated to get perfectly true, and that what you're doing instead is trying to form a theory which is true enough so that it correctly predicts real-world events. You can think of lots of examples in economics where, if you think about it, you can't prove X is true, but you have good reasons to believe X is true.
So we really have, if we have two short questions, we have time for that. We don't have time for a third question. Please go ahead.
David, in respect to the article that you talked about, empirical testing, what I'd like to see empirical testing is go back in time, put some iron ore in Japan, see how that evolution of things go forward. That's obviously impossible. Could you enlighten us on how did you test your theory empirically, and B, how do you, in your field, how do you control for the fact that somebody might do 10 empirical tests, 8 fail, and only publish 2?
Right. That is, the way my father put it was that in some ways statistical work had gotten less useful with the improvement in computers. Because it used to be the case that running run regression was a lot of work. And once you can do the regression in, 5 minutes on your computer, you can do 100 of them and only report the one that works. That was a point he made a long time ago. But to really answer your question, I should point you at the article, which is on my webpage. And it's a theory of the size and shape of nations. But the basic theory had to do with the fact that some forms of taxes, one government can collect more from territory than if the territory is divided among multiple governments. And in particular, a tax on a trade route, if you have multiple governments along a trade route, they'll overtax for familiar reasons. Therefore, if your main revenue source is trade, there is going to be pressure to unify that route under a single government. That was sort of the logic of it, except trade is only one example. The last example is if individuals are wealthy enough so that you can tax incomes, which I'm arguing is happening about the 18th, 19th century, then the problem from the standpoint of the government is how do you prevent competition? How do you keep people from leaving you if you charge? And there are three solutions to that problem. One of them is too big. It is a big country. That's very expensive. So almost everybody's far from the border. One of them is building a wall around your country. That was the Soviet solution. That's very expensive. The ingenious solution is to draw your national boundaries along linguistic and cultural boundaries, because no Frenchman wants to move to a place where they speak German. And I argued, therefore, that my theory explained the rise of linguistic nationalism at roughly the 18th century, which is sort of a common fact, but my theory explained it. But explaining the tests of it would take a while. But it basically involved using the fact that water transport was much cheaper than land transport. Therefore, you could roughly figure out what the trade routes are by looking at a city and the river that connect to the ocean, and you could then see whether nations were non-randomly oriented along trade routes at the times when my argument said that trade was the main source of income, and whether they were non-randomly oriented along linguistic boundaries more at the point when income started going up so you could want to tax people. That's very, very short, but I can't describe it in much detail.
Our last question before the conclusions.
All right. Over the course of the debate, you brought up lots of examples of very unusual types of preferences and orderings of preferences and behaviors of preferences. And I was
could you talk a little bit closer there?
And behaviors of preferences. I was wondering between you, which school is best able to model unusual preferences? So, for example, in economics, we're constantly deriving rules that should be universalizable. So, for example, a good that is both easily storable, non-perishable, and easily convertible to cash should be desirable in infinite amounts, pretty much. You should always desire more of that good sooner than you would later. And yet, many of us have had alcoholic friends that would not want to receive 5 years' supply of Kentucky bourbon all in one shipment. They'd rather have that doled out over the 5 years. So between Chicago and Austrian school, which school is best able to explain unhealthy, healthy, non-rational, non-economical orderings of preferences?
The short answer is that neither of them is, because Mises's starting point is human action is purposive behavior. My starting point is rationality defined as individuals tend to take those actions that best. Individuals have objectives and tend to take those actions that best achieve them. So both my, at least I can't speak for all Austrians, both my approach and Mises's approach are implicitly predicting people as if they were rational. And the best attempt to get beyond that would be Kahneman's work, where he tried to create essentially what you might think of as a theory of irrationality, or alternatively, a theory where being rational is itself costly, and therefore you choose to apply your rationality. He has this two forms of mind, basically, mind one and mind two. One of them is actually thinking about things. The other is acting on sort of rules of thumb. And his argument is that you act on rules of thumb. One can interpret his arguments, you act on rules of thumb on the less important things, you think about the more, and attention is a limited resource. So one way of looking at Kahneman's work is that it's abolishing the economic assumption of rationality. The other is that it's expanding it to include the cost of thinking, essentially, the cost of attention.
My brief answer to your point would be that, one example that Austrians like to use is, you're passing through a town, you'll never return to that town again, but you get fantastic service at the restaurant and you'll leave a large tip. But that doesn't further your own interest. It's not rational. I do think that, again, my own view is that in a way, there is a great deal of overlap. Exactly what I just read from Mises is economics and is economic history. I don't think that would offend David or Milton Friedman, but I do believe that the Austrians, when they talk about purpose of behavior and they don't use the word rational, they're just a little bit more open to all the ways in which people pursue purposes. I mean, Rothbard liked to use the example of a, you know, company, you've got to hire your ne'er-do-well brother-in-law in order to establish peace in the family. I mean, that's your purpose in that case. You know, so it's a little bit more open to all of the ways in which people's behavior is not quite just the sort of thing you could put on a graph with profit maximization.
For my equivalent of that, take a look at the economics of virtue and vice, which I have written up in a couple of places, including my Substack.
He's also a great Austrian economist of time.
We now move to the conclusion, 5 minutes each.
Well, I guess I want to apologize for taking your time by focusing on what might have been regarded as trivialities. I wanted to hone in on specific lessons that we could all grasp within a brief period of time. To review the points, David's response to the idea of ordinal versus cardinal utility is first to cite indifference curves. And again, I would submit that whatever we are indifferent to, you could draw curves, you could talk about it, but whatever we are indifferent to, if it really doesn't matter whether it's just this pile of beans or that pile of beans or that pile of sugar or this different brand of sugar, we're indifferent to it. I don't see how it specifically relates to the importance of human action. And of course, and I'm just quoting Rothbard in that case. He thought it was a waste of intellectual time. It gets you nowhere. There's no reason to belabor it. And it certainly does not speak to the issue of cardinal versus ordinal utility. It's because it doesn't speak to the point that we are not computers. We don't calculate these things. David went into some kind of point about lotteries. And I guess it's possible that there were, just because David can make up examples about weird people, I guess there are weird people who can really say, I prefer this massage parlor twice as great as this one, and I never change. The only point is that the Austrians are just able to arrive at economic insights without getting too quantitative or starting to draw curves that sort of get them grounded in away from the importance of human action and into the real world. And the only other part of it, as I mentioned, was that the answer to the socialists, which I do think is fundamental, is that David goes part of the way by mentioning the fact that the capitalist waits, but it doesn't go all the way by pointing out that the capitalist does indeed add nothing. It all comes from labor capital. Doesn't go all the way by emphasizing entrepreneurship. And in the passages that I quoted, he says, well, we're buying too much. It's really marginal. He doesn't emphasize the fundamental role of the capitalist. And then again, as I've said, challenging him, nowhere in his book do you read that capital really only derives from land and labor. When I first read that in Rothbard, I thought that was a key insight, a simple enough insight. And by the way, part of it, I guess, is that what the Austrians like to do, say, insights that once they become apparent, do become simple, as simple enough for us to grasp. And that really, when you buy capital goods on the market, you're buying capital goods that came from land and labor, and you might be using them for some special entrepreneurial purpose. And that the market is really a process, but through which entrepreneurship happens all the time. When David mentioned something about just using words, that is indeed part of what the Austrians like to do, because they do like to talk about human action in words, because the words will usually describe it. Occasionally, you can use a graph or a number to illustrate the point. And once again, as mentioned, the subjectivity of our choices really shouldn't be determined by whether the car needs four wheels or whether it's a six-wheeler or an 18-wheeler or whether it can run on one wheel or whether we need four eggs or just one large egg. The subjectivity is what determines it, and the declining margin of utility is all there. With that said, I bought a copy of Law's Order and I read it. With that said, the overlap, and many, we could have, David and I could argue about a number of other things, but the overlap between me and David is great. David has it wrong. Mises did respect economic history. Economic history, because indeed, David calls it forecasting, really. And look, if you're going to forecast the future through your empiricism, as David well knows, economists are not exactly the best forecasters. The colleague of Milton Friedman, who wrote the famous Monetary History, was completely clueless about the economic collapse that was about to happen in 2008. So it really isn't forecasting that economists do. They can try forecasting, but that too is a mistaken word. Basically, it's analyzing history and then thinking that if history has gone in this way, then possibly the history will continue in the future, even though we are often subject to surprises. But again, those are really the only limited lessons that the Chicago School economist David Friedman could benefit from. Thank you.
To begin with, I think both of us probably owe an apology to the audience for picking a rather poorly stated proposition to argue. Because in particular, Gene does not have the opportunity to say there are positive things that Chicago economists believe that are false. That would not contribute to his claim, which is that there are positive things that Austrian economists believe that are true. In general, we don't get to do a proper argument about the relative virtues of the two. We're much too narrow. I would like to point out that although I don't think my failure to emphasize the fact that capital does not derive from land and labor is in fact anything important, it doesn't matter, because the proposition that Gene is defending has a plural word in it. It's intuitions. So even if he can find one intuition that meets his criterion, he still loses the debate. I am aware that Mises thought that economic history mattered. The question is, what is the role of facts in determining economic truth? And I think most of the Austrians, probably not all of them, because Austrians don't all agree with them, try to take the position, certainly Rothbard does, that you can work out your economic truth a priori from certainty, facts you know with certainty about people. And that means that although you could then look at economic history, it might give you some ideas that hadn't occurred to you, it does not use to, cannot be used to figure out what the true economic views of. I agree that predicting economies is hard, certainly not what I do, but I am reminded of somebody's comment that Austrian economists have succeeded in predicting 12 of the last three recessions. And one problem with prediction, of course, I could go into the standard, as you may know, the standard way of making money if you have an investment newsletter. Not really the standard, but what in effect is happening is you get 1,000 customers, potential customers. You send 500 of them a free newsletter saying that the market's going to go up and 500 saying it's going to go down. The ones who you guessed right on, you cross off the others, and you then send 250 word that Microsoft is going to go up and 250 that Microsoft is going to go down. And after you've done this three times, you're down to an eighth of your original people, all of whom know you've guessed right three times in a row. My guess is that almost nobody does that, but they don't have to, because it works just the same way if you start out with eight honest people with different views, and four of them make one prediction and four of them make the other, and then the four that made the predictions turn out to be wrong lose their customers. Maybe they start another newsletter with a new name. And so forth down. So using predictions as a way of of evaluating things, of evaluating the economy, predicting the economy doesn't work very well. On the other hand, you can, if you have a particular theory, as I did with the size of nations, say, what predictions does this make, and then test them and get at least a little information, but certainly less than certain. In any case, if you want to get a better account of my side of the argument than you can from this, the two things you want to look at are my book, Hidden Order, which is an attempt, in a sense, it was inspired in a way by The Selfish Gene, which is my standard example of a book by a professional in a field who makes it fun to learn the field. So read Hidden Order and read my critique of a version of Austrian economics, which is on my, it's a Substack, and the links to my Substacks are on my webpage, sorted. And that will at least give you both my view of economics and my view of what is wrong with Rothbard economics. Thank you.
So two economists walk into a bar. The first economist says to the bartender, I'll have a beer.
Should have found a better proposition.
The bartender asks, can you pay for that? The economist says, no, but I can tell you why you're not making a profit. The second economist says, well, I'll have the same thing, but I'll tell you why the first economist is wrong. But it is up to you now to tell us who won this debate. Please go to SohoVote.com. SohoVote.com. And please place your vote. I want to thank David Friedman and Gene Epstein for giving us an enlightening discussion on the two different schools.
Well, I guess you clap for him and he gets to clap for me. I'm not supposed to clap for myself.
I'm clapping for you, David.
Right, I'm clapping for you.
So for the much-desired Tootsie Roll of the Soho Forum, the proposition that Austrian economics of Mises and Rothbard contains economic intuitions that are important, correct, and missing from the Chicago School of Economics. The results. So starting for the affirmative, yes. Pre was 59.62%, and post went down to 34.62, a change of negative 25%. And no, started at 3.85%, and post 38.5%. So the Tootsie Roll goes to David.
Lunch.